As Richard III, Kevin Spacey plays a man who will stop at nothing to gain power and will do anything he can to keep it. He stars in the final production of the three-year-long Bridge Project, which is at the BAM Harvey Theater now through March 4th. And joining me now is Hayden Gwynn, who plays Queen Elizabeth, one of the few characters in Shakespeare's play who actually stands up to Richard. Welcome to our show.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Kevin Spacey plays Richard III as a conniving, bloodthirsty power grabber, but also as being kind of bored by how easily he can outsmart most of the people around him. Does he assume that he can run all over your character, Elizabeth, as well?
I think he does, up to a point. I think he is not expecting the fight that he, you know, at least the intellectual fight that he gets with her in the second act. But there is also a line early in the play when he's talking about her son, who teases him, the Duke of York, the younger prince, where he describes he's been teased and he's talking to Buckingham, said, oh, he is, I can't remember, ingenious, forward, capable. There's a sort of list of adjectives, and then he says he's all the mothers from top to toe. Now, he may not say it with great love, but, you know, it shows that he does, even if he loathes her, he respects her intelligence.
And obviously Shakespeare is telling us that this is to come. He's kind of alerting us to the fact that Elizabeth is more than just somebody who is a minor character.
You know, has Shakespeare originally seeded that? How did he write his plays? Did he know where he was going when he started? Who knows? But it was useful for me to go that whatever you think about this woman, her intellect is, as we see by the end of the play. I mean, it's interesting to compare the two scenes. The first, her very first scene, where she's with the whole court and Richard is being extremely rude in a way, but that Shakespeare does not at that point allow her there. She's very much bested by, you know, he wins that round and she comes across as rather petulant. It's not until the second half, where she's lost everything, you know, and lost her children.
And she's been driven to this, and then he's making this outrageous request of her.
Yes. Well, she has nothing, having killed most of her relatives and, you know, most importantly, her children, her young children, he's then wanting to marry her daughter, an outrageous request.
After he's killed his first queen.
Also, mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is not a good sign.
Henry VIII. It's not a good scene.
Shakespeare wrote this knowing about what happened with Henry VIII. I wonder whether that was in the back of his mind.
Well, it was a very bloody time, wasn't it? He was, as you rightly say, he was writing at the time of Elizabeth, so within the Tudor court, that Richard is vanquished by Richmond, who becomes the first Tudor king. So it's very much told from the Tudor point of view. And there's a whole society in England, the Richard III Society, dedicated to rescuing the reputation of the real Richard III. But obviously that's not something that Shakespeare could do, and he's painted as evilly as he possibly could be. And I think that's what the audience love about it. You know, he's a completely, mostly unrepentant villain who revels in what he's up to.
But Shakespeare was also politically astute. He would have made Richard III an evil character because...
Yes, that's
this
what
is
I'm
the,
saying.
The
he
end
had,
of the,
he had
the,
to. That's yeah, exactly what I mean.
It's the end
yes.
of the War of the Roses.
Yeah,
and
he would
and
have
Richard
no,
loses.
He would have absolutely no choice but to do that.
There are... this is also one of Shakespeare's longest plays.
Yes, certainly the role, the Richard role, I think, is the second longest in the canon after Hamlet. So it's a massive undertaking in terms of stamina and learning and everything else for the actor playing Richard. And I think one has to remember it's very early Shakespeare, and, you know, 20 years later when he's writing, am I allowed to say, the Scottish play here, Macbeth and King Lear and whatever, you know, he's learned to give his leading actor a break at some point in the play. At this time, with just a few, you know, not long scenes, he's on all the time.
And the way Kevin Spacey is playing it with a brace on one of his legs and some other things, including one of the most shocking endings. We're not going to reveal it, but a truly shocking.
Did you find it shocking? what we're talking about, yeah, which must be very frustrating.
I was not expecting it, and I thought, okay, why would any actor put himself through that?
Ah, well, because we can't discuss it, I can't, but I, well, I think,
unless you're willing
personally,
to.
I personally think that thing that we're talking about, actually, I think Kevin would agree, is incredibly beneficial for him, because I think, in terms of physically what he has to do in the play, I think it's it acts as a therapy against it. So I don't think Kevin minds.
Like most of Shakespeare's tragedies, there's some comedy, and Kevin Spacey makes the most of those funny lines with his deadpan expressions. As he says just about anything to get and maintain power. Are you ever surprised by which lines get laughs from the audience?
Sometimes. What's been particularly interesting doing this job, I mean, obviously, as you read it, you have the line, you know, Shakespeare has written a lot of, deliberately funny lines for Richard. It's one of the reasons the role is so popular. And Kevin, God knows, has found a lot more to have fun with. One of my complaints to Sam Mendes, I mean, jokingly, when he offered the role, was that as far as my character was concerned, there weren't enough jokes. But but what's been... So you do, as you go through, you never know until you throw a play in front of an audience. There are always surprises. What's been particularly interesting about doing this production is because we've taken it around the world and we've taken it to a lot of non-English speaking countries. You know, we did it in this huge ancient amphitheater in Epidavros in Greece, you know, holding 2,500-year-old theater, holding 12,000 people ago, no microphones. You know, they're watching surtitles, which are Hong Kong, Italy, Istanbul, Beijing, you know, all the Middle East. What's really interesting is in almost every country there'd be lines where suddenly they would laugh at something. You would have absolutely no idea why, but there would be some political, cultural, some sort of relevance or resonance for them. And that's always been fun, the bits that are different.
Because every country has had its own power-hungry leader at one time or another. But you're now at the Bam Harvey, which just feels like it's 2,000 years old.
Yes, I love it. I had never been before, and I loved it. I loved the way it looks.
You know, I used to go there when it was a movie theater.
It's about to crash on top of your head. It isn't, I hasten to add, anybody who's thinking.
No, they've distressed it on purpose, but I used to go there when it was the Majestic movie theater.
And is that it was? So it was a movie theater originally.
It was never a fancy one,
yes,
but they had triple features usually.
Brilliant.
But it's just such a marvelous place. What is it for actors in that space?
Well, I really like the space. It's quite a curious, and it's technically a bit of a challenge.
Are there dead spots?
It feels, on the one hand, it's not so much... I don't know if it's so much dead spots. It's you've got this thing of the audience. Some of the audience are incredibly close. I mean, literally, the front row is sort of on the stage. You're not on a stage that's raised above the audience. So you've got a steep bank up. It feels very intimate from the front. But what you might call that the mezzanine is above is very high. It's very resonant, which is nice, which is good for volume, but it can be deceptive. You know, you need a lot of articulation in there, and you have to remember that although you're feeling, like with any theatre, you're feeling your audience very close because of the ones you're seeing literally 2 feet away from you at your feet. It is also a big space, and there are people. You've got to make it work for the people sitting at the back at the top as well.
That big scene that you have with Richard, where he's trying to convince you to allow him to marry your daughter, you don't get any jokes. You say, well, of course you can't.
But she does have a couple.
But you are outraged. And it's a very long, dramatic scene. Do you find yourself gearing up for it?
Gearing up for it. The scene before, actually, in a way, helps you to gear up for it, this rather extraordinary scene with the three women, with Margaret and the Duchess of York, Richard's mother, and the queen, who is the enemy from the other side of the Wars of the Roses, that they have this strange sort of almost what Margaret says ritualized verse speaking. I was worried when I first, you know, when I was reading, when I was sort of trying to learn it, Sam Mendes asked us to learn the show before we, as much as possible before we started rehearsing.
This is pretty close to the complete script, isn't it? The complete Shakespeare?
Well, it's...
Everybody edits it a bit.
It is edited a bit, but it's you know, there's a lot of it still there. Sometimes Margaret, you know, when you're not doing it in the context of the history cycle, is removed altogether. I mean, I'm very glad she isn't, because it's an extraordinary role.
Well, but Sam what Mendes she says, seems to have wanted to make the women more important in a play that is a male-dominated play.
Yes, I think in a way he has focused the women very well, and in their contrast to what the men are up to and the political machinations. You know, they represent the cost of war, the cost of all this violence and political maneuvering. What you were saying about the gearing up is that I was worried when I was learning it, thinking, oh my God, look at this. You know, first of all, her husband's dying. Oh, now he's dead. Now her kids are being kidnapped. Oh, now they're dead. Oh, now, you know, it's like, this is going to be a bit of a miserable ride. Imagining that maybe I would have to sort of gear myself up, particularly before the second half. But actually, what I find is that. But with that scene before the big confrontation, Shakespeare's sort of words sort of take you there. So if you just listen, and you can be in it quickly without sort of being off stage trying to work yourself up.
Do the women in this play highlight Richard's progression in his cruelty from his mother to his sister-in-law to his wife?
How do you mean highlight? Do they?
Well, we see, you know, we understand a man wanting power. But often that doesn't involve also doing terrible things to the women.
They do, really. It's only that I think they do, because it's just that Shakespeare's chosen what I just said, that the women represent the cost. Mm-hmm. You know, by bringing the women on, you know, what happens when you kill someone's children or their father or their, you know, husband or their son or their, you know, they are the only ones out there who are properly calling him on what he's doing.
We don't have a lot of time, but I want to talk a bit about the Bridge Project. This is the third and final year of the Bridge Project, which created a theater company that combined British and American actors. And this production was in London first, and then you say you took it around the world. In Britain, most actors start off doing Shakespeare. In this country, or
it's
did
not
in
true.
The past,
yes,
not true anymore?
Well, I'm not a really quite the right person to ask, in that I didn't have a typical British
you
actor's
didn't do that
route
Rada
through. No, I started very late. I lived in Italy for years, and in fact, I didn't go to drama school, but I did. I did join the RSC some years ago, so I have, you know, over the sort of dotted through my career, I have done quite a bit of Shakespeare, but so I suppose there is still, if a British, I suppose here's the difference, if a British actor wants to, he can maybe, I don't know if this is true or not, he can seek it out, you know, he can try and get to the RSC or whatever, but you know, I think that whole thing of what you were talking about, regional theatre, what you called rep theatre, where there would, or, you know, there isn't as much opportunity perhaps as there once was. But were you going to ask something about the whole
thing?
Well,
I was just going to ask about coordinating people who generally have started with Shakespeare as a basis, and then others who come to it.
Yes,
later.
But I think
many,
you know,
of these people started in movies.
Yes, but I think increasingly that can be true in England as well. So, in fact, perhaps it's more that the level of experience with Shakespeare in this company. I would say there are Americans in this cast who've done a lot of Shakespeare, and Brits who haven't. So, in fact, we're mixed. You know, we're a mixed bunch. Like that on both sides of the Atlantic, if you like.
You won the Drama Desk Award and were nominated for Tony for your role as a dance teacher, Mrs. Wilkinson, in Billy Elliot in 2009. Do you prefer doing one over, I mean, a musical? now this.
Yes. It's always about the role. I think the one thing I will say is people come to me, you know, because it, you know, it's Shakespeare and it's tragedy, and let alone the journey that my character has, which, as you say, is pretty heavy. And they look at me pityingly and go, how do you do it? How do you do these two shows, you know, on a Saturday? And the truth is, yes, it is tiring. the truth is, it's not as tiring as doing a musical. Of course, when you do a musical, like Billy Elliot, people come to you and go, oh, you must be having so much fun. But the physical demands of
singing
solos and dancing and keeping yourself on stage 8 shows a week is harder. So what I like about this is that I can allow myself a glass of wine or two after the show, which I was never able to do on Billy Elliot, rarely.
There is music in this as well, mostly drums, and everybody has to learn how to play drums.
They do. I'm one of the few who, three of us had to be pulled out because of what we do within the show, but we all started doing it, drum rehearsal every Friday afternoon. We were incredibly lucky, as you say, it's mostly a percussion score, and this was a great privilege in that we had our composer, Mark Bennett, and who's American, and our keyboard our keyboardist and percussionist with us in the rehearsal room every day from the first day for 6 weeks, right the way through rehearsal. So that score was built in incredibly organically, and Sam had very strong ideas about what he wanted, and that was being adjusted and played with as we went along. And I think that really comes through.
Now, it's at BAM and, through March 4th, and then is that the end of this?
This is it, yes. This is the last drops of water out of the plug hole of this particular job, yes.
Hayden Gwynn plays Queen Elizabeth, a different Queen Elizabeth, of course, in Richard III, part of the Bridge Project at the BAM Harvey Theater at 651 Fulton Street in Brooklyn through March 4th. And if you want information about tickets, you can visit our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.